If I could go back, you know, 6 years ago and know that actually what I needed to do was ask to open my marriage and to live in separate houses and to not present normatively as a couple and do all this couple-y centric kind of settler family presentation to the world. But I didn't know that, right? Like, I totally didn't know that that's what was going on. But being a solo person now, it's easier for me, I recognize, than to open a long-term marriage. I have a lot of sympathy for how difficult that must be.
If you're happy with the same old ways of dating,
if you enjoy sucking at communication,
and you have no desire to improve your romantic life, then our podcast might not be for you.
But if you want some out-of-the-box ideas to deepen your current relationships,
broaden your sexual horizons,
develop a better understanding of yourself,
or learn more about non-monogamy,
then you've come to the right place. I'm Jace.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Dedeker.
And this is the Multiamory Podcast. On this episode of the Multiamory Podcast, we're talking with author and professor Kim Tallbear about settler sexuality. So Dedeker is a huge fan of her work, and so I'm going to let her do the introduction.
Yeah, I'm really excited about today. So Kim Tallbear is an associate professor, Faculty of Native Studies, University of Alberta, and Canada Research Chair in Indigenous Peoples, Technoscience, and Environment. Dr. Tallbear is the author of Native American DNA, Tribal Belonging and the False Promise of Genetic Science, and she's also the author of the Critical Polyamorist blog. She's a regular commentator in U.S., Canadian, and U.K. media outlets on issues related to Indigenous peoples, science, and technology. She's a citizen of the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate.
Yeah, so you've been a fan of Kim's for quite a while,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, long time.
Yeah, so we're very excited to finally have her on the show to talk about all that stuff.
Well, Kim, thank you so much for coming on the show today. We're really excited to talk to you.
Thanks for inviting me.
I have to say, like, I am fangirling a tiny bit because I've been following your work for a while, and I've just been like, oh my God, you're such a good writer. And I just love the way that you express your thoughts in a way that's both very academic and accessible, I find, which I think is kind of hard, especially for someone who's in your position and like doing the work that you do. And you recently, you gave the keynote speech at Solo PolyCon, the most recent Solo PolyCon. Right. And part of your talk centered on this concept of settler sexuality being this structure that a lot of our relationships adhere to, whether we're conscious of it or not. And can you give us and our listeners just a brief rundown of what exactly you refer to when you're talking about settler sexuality?
Sure. And I'm glad to hear I'm accessible because that you never know, right? If you're an academic. I feel like I'm accessible, but I'm not. So that's good to hear.
Definitely.
So settler sexuality is a term that Scott Morgenson, who is a kind of queer theorist at Queen's University, I think is made really more popular in the academic literature. And so I've learned a lot by reading Scott and other both Indigenous and non-Indigenous queer theorists. He's non-Indigenous. And I wish I had his definition in front of me. Basically, though, the way that I think about it in terms of what I've learned is that it's the imposition of this kind of idea of sexual modernity that sort of arises in the late 19th, early 20th century as settler states. So particularly the U.S. and Canada are developing as nations. There's a very kind of intense moment of development happening there right after the Indian Wars and all of this, and the Indian land and native land is being taken and kind of divided up into individual allotments, and settlers are moving farther and farther west. So the way that these nation states have sort of promoted sexuality, marriage, and private property, all as a bundle, have been really central to the development of the nation state. Now, people tend to think about our sexuality, particularly I think non-monogamists often sort of push back against normative forms of sexuality, and they often attribute them more to religion, and I think not enough to the state. But it's not only the church that was imposing these kinds of ideas. It really was very much the state and academic disciplines. You have the term homosexual actually defined before heterosexual gets defined, because the state and its health authorities and psychologists were attempting to monitor and make people comply with these emerging sexual norms. And those emerging sexual norms really are tied up with the state and private property and regulating and controlling people. And so that's what I mean when I'm talking about settler sexuality.
Got it. Yeah, that's a really interesting definition. And I,
yeah.
something I wanted to ask too, to kind of clarify on that a little bit more. So I feel like, gosh, maybe over the past 2 or 3 years, I feel like I've seen a fair number of articles, especially within the non-monogamy world, pop up that talk about essentially like colonial sexuality or about decolonizing relationships, things like that. And I've heard both, like, this term became very popular and that concept became very popular. And at the same time, I heard some sort of criticism of that, saying, well, actually, you're kind of trying to use this to mean something different, or the idea that we could decolonize relationships isn't even possible. I was just curious, because to me, like, settler and colonizer sound very similar. And I wondered, are those terms related? Are they, do you know what I mean? Like, what's the connection between those two things, if you know more about that than I do?
Sure. And I'll come back to something else about settler sexuality, I should have said. Yeah, in Canada, we tend to, especially in the academy, we tend to use the word settler a lot. In the US, it's much less common to use that term. In fact, a lot of people in the US that I've talked to think it sounds too polite, that we should say invader or something like that. But it doesn't sound polite in Canada. And people don't, there are people here who don't like that term, say, any better than the term white. And there's a big debate going on as to who you identify as a settler and who you don't. But yes, it's those who came with colonizing power. Right, and in that colonial moment, and their descendants. And then there is a big discussion about who, you know, are people of color settlers. That's the one of the things that gets debated. You know, many people would say no, many of them are not, right? So then we can come back to decolonial sexualities in a minute. But the other thing I was going to say is, when you're thinking about settler sexuality, another key part of that is to be a good, productive, normal citizen. And what is it to be a productive citizen? It's to reproduce. It's to have biological children. So that's how settler sexuality becomes heterosexual and heteronormative. But you've got people like Scott Morgenson and other queer theorists saying, yes, but now we have homonormativity. We have gay people trying to fit into these ideas of what's a good, productive citizen, you know, having children. Children, being good homeowners, trying to get all the things that they need to get access to the full array of rights that citizens are supposed to have. And our sexuality has been deeply tied up with what it is to be a good citizen, our relationship to private property. So it's not only straights that get included in settler sexuality, although it certainly has been much for a much longer time, straights have been privileged in that. But increasingly, we have what we would call homonormativity as well. And all of this is about our relationships and our family styles and our relationships to property supporting the state.
Right. I wanted to jump on, you mentioned the productive citizen specifically, that it's not just about being a good citizen, it's about being a productive citizen. And it is interesting that, of course, reproduction is wrapped up in that. But I also see it's kind of this sense of, you know, the sex that you're having, even, it, you know, it also has to be productive and not for pleasure necessarily, that like your relationships and your sex, you know, because it's all about maximizing efficiency, maximizing what you're producing, which means minimizing time that you're spent, you know, goofing off and having pleasure, essentially.
That does seem rather religious, though, in nature to me. I mean, I'm probably the least equipped person to talk about religion here, but still, it, from what I know, that does seem kind of the narrative, that sex should be strictly for reproduction, when one looks at it from like a very biblical standpoint, I guess, and not for pleasure.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's, religion is certainly plays a part in this, but you can see that it's the three parties that I look at as heavily regulating our sexuality are the church and the state and science. And the church, the state, and science have all been overwhelmingly run by straight white men in the West, right? Yeah. And so it's always straight white men who are telling us what it is to be sexually normal. And science has tried to define that, right? The state's defined it and the church has defined it, and they all work together, even though sometimes they fight between themselves and act like they're separate. As an indigenous thinker, I don't see those institutions as separate as they might see themselves, because they were all used again as a bundle to institute these kind of settler cultural norms and standards. They all work together.
Well, that's interesting, actually. I think it's funny because, Emily, you brought up like, oh, I think I'm the least qualified person to talk about religion. Because the thing is that, like, both myself and Jace were raised evangelical Christian. And then Emily was a raised atheist, but Emily, you've commented on the fact that even though you were raised atheist, there's a lot of cultural norms around sexuality and relationships that you still internalized, even not having basically anything to do with religion in your upbringing.
Sure. And clearly that's just simply the way in which I was raised, the way in which people tend to be raised, I think, in a Western society, that like sex is for a certain thing or it's for people that you're in love with and that, you know, you shouldn't be doing it otherwise. Even though obviously the three of us, you know, don't exactly do that or, you know, think of sex in a different way, not so strictly for biological purposes or just because you have to be in love with someone in order to want it.
So I guess just to follow up on the question about settler sexuality, you mentioned this just briefly, that there's debate about, you know, who are settlers and who isn't. Is this something where, you know, if you're a white person, you're just screwed in this respect? And, you know, like what does that mean? What's that debate look like?
Well, so people talk about, so people that are coming here under duress, right, like refugees or asylum seekers, you know, no matter what color they are, you probably wouldn't call them a settler, right? There was a debate, people are very unwilling to call, say, African Americans who are descended from enslaved people settlers, right? Their ancestors were brought here forcibly. But I'll give you a good example of how this doesn't just only break down along the lines of race. You would, most people who deal with the settler terminology in the academy would never call somebody like Michelle Obama a settler, right? But Barack Obama, I would say you could make a good argument that because his mom was a middle-class white anthropologist and his father was a relatively privileged immigrant from, I think, Kenya, who came over for education. Pretty textbook definition of a settler. Yet we would define Barack Obama as African-American and Michelle Obama as African-American, but they have very different genealogies in terms of how their ancestors came to North America, right? And right. So that's just an example of how you can't just substitute it for white people all of the time. Although, and of course, there are people who might come to code as white who we would say also came under duress. Anyway, it is a term that, again, we're pretty comfortable using in Canada, but it's just not really taken off in the U.S. And I don't know if that's because there is a greater history of slavery down there and it's just more complicated. I'm not sure, but people don't tend to be very comfortable with it down there. From my perspective, I don't run around worrying about who to identify as a settler as an individual. What I talk and write about is the imposition of settler colonial institutions and cultures and authorities, and all of us are capable of upholding that. And this is one of the reasons I'm really writing strongly against state-sanctioned marriage. There's plenty of Native people who buy into state-sanctioned marriage, right? There's plenty of us who buy into private property now, and it's very hard to extract ourselves from the settler colonial kind of institutions. It's not just an individual choice to decolonize. Right. But I do tend to want to focus on the structures more than individuals in my work.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense for having these conversations.
And
something that we touched on briefly also was that you mentioned in your writings that even non-traditional relationships or people who are homosexual, queer sexualities, they can still uphold these like settler sexuality constructs. So how do you really see that manifesting? Is that narrative changing, or do you see it still kind of upholding in the same way that it has been for many years?
Well, you know, the way that I would use the word queer is the way that my friend and colleague Angie Willey would use the word queer. She wrote the book Undoing Monogamy. She says to be queer is to be against the state. So I don't think probably just because one is not straight that one is queer. I personally, and the theorists that I read, would probably make a difference between, you know, queer isn't all encompassing of all non-normative sexualities. I think it really does involve a critique of the state. And this is one of the things that, this is why I've started reading so much queer theory as an Indigenous theorist. There are so many queer thinkers out there that have the same critiques of how science and the church and the state have marginalized our bodies, marginalized our communities, used us as these kind of raw materials for research and for experimentation. And so when I got into graduate school and I saw that queer theorists were particularly making the same critiques of science that I made as an Indigenous woman, that's when I really started to read their stuff. And I thought, we need to be at the same conversational table. And also the way that they tend to try to do kinship differently, because a lot of queer folks have been ostracized from their families of birth, right? And they've learned how to make family.
Right.
There's a lot in common with Indigenous ways of kin making there. And so that's why I'm so in conversation with them. So that's how I use the word queer.
Yeah.
No, that's thank you for clarifying that, because that's honestly, that's a very different definition of queer than I've ever heard before, and that I feel like most people that I know use. So that is really useful I guess this is why academic papers tend to start out by being like, let's define some terms that we're going to use. So I'm going to do something that most writers probably dislike, and that's, I'm going to quote you to yourself. So in your keynote speech from Solo Polycon, you said, many of us, referring to the Dakota, I believe, you said, many of us continue to live in extended family where the legally married couple is not central, where children are raised in community, and where households often spill over beyond nuclear family and across generations. Can we not then also imagine sexual intimacies outside of settler family structures? I know we already have them. Can we name and measure them without using settler sex and family forms as reference points? I thought that was a fantastic question, and I wanted to ask you that question. Can we measure them and talk about them without everything having to be in reference to some sort of settler sexuality, some of sort of state-sanctioned sexuality that we have now?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard. This is, I'm trying to do work that is focusing on webs of relation and being in relation versus the kinds of categories that we usually invoke. So we talk about being straight, or we talk about being gay or queer. We talk about being a wife or a girlfriend or whatever our categories are. And instead of identifying ourselves biologically or socially, I would like us to think about more fluid terms. And I think one of the ways we can do that is to get away from these kinds of definitive ideas of who we are, as if we were born that way, or even if we're hard social constructionists and we think we were socialized that way. What if we just simply if we look at the way that we are relating in particular instances and with whom we're relating? And I relate to my daughter, I relate to my other biological family members, I relate to lovers, I relate to friends. Sometimes it's always not clear who's a friend and who's a lover, right? I relate to non-humans, you know. The prairie is really important to me. The sky is important to me. There are people to whom their animals are important to them. You know, I'm not one of those people that has pets and things like that. But I do want us to begin to think more about what's the particular intimacy that we are having in that particular moment. And of course, it should always be a consensual intimacy, right?
Right.
But that's what I try to think about. I try to think about this web of relations and take us out of these hard categories into this kind of spatial metaphor where I'm thinking about, where am I on the web? Whom am I relating to, and how am I relating to them? And that might sometimes involve a conjoining of bodies that could fall under this definition of sex. But I'm trying to find other ways to talk about that and think about that. And this is also one of the groups that I'm really interested in talking to are asexual people who define as asexual.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of liberation to be had in getting away from thinking in terms of this is sex and this is not sex, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And just thinking more in terms of how are we being intimate, and how are we trying to be appropriately and consensually intimate? And, you know, maybe we don't have to define that as sex even when it involves acts like that sometimes. Right. I don't know if that's too abstract, but.
No, that's fantastic. I love it. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah. To kind of further go with this question, I think that something I've noticed when, you know, when non-traditional relationship type people are trying to find, like trying to get out of these sort of traditional labels of girlfriend, or like, this one's a partner because I have sex with them and this person's a friend because I don't, when they're trying to get away from that, I have noticed that, unfortunately, I feel like something that can happen is looking to other cultures, and then kind of ends up like, I'm going to try to appropriate some of these ideas or some of these other concepts that we've had. And I think it seems like we have such a desire to have words to describe the types of relations
a
we
label.
Have.
Right.
Yeah. And it's, Yeah. And it's so hard. I think we all struggle with this a lot, because a lot of what you're saying sounds a lot like relationship anarchy, mm-hmm. this idea yeah. of yeah. rather than you put on a label and now you get this whole set of things that comes with it, that each thing you're picking out sort of a la carte, as it were. Like, well, mm-hmm. this relationship's going to have this thing in it and this thing and not mm-hmm. this other thing and this thing, rather than just like, well, I have one label, so I have to have everything that goes with it. But it does become so hard to not have those labels, to mm-hmm. not have those words.
Yeah. My co-parent is actually a professor at the University of Virginia, and he reads more of the anarchy literature than I do. And he said, actually, there's a book out, which I haven't gotten yet, that where this archaeologist talks about some of the indigenous communities in California having actually been sort of organized anarchists, is what he would call it. So I do think there might be some overlap, and that would be an interesting area to look at. And it might be why my sort of core values about relationships and relations, which I do feel that I've inherited from my Dakota upbringing, despite all the colonization, I think some kind of fundamental ideas about relations came through. It might be why I have such resonance when I hear about what relationship anarchists think and do, you know, mm-hmm. that it makes a lot more sense to me. And I probably, when I have time to dig deeper down into those conversations in literature, I will probably begin to identify more with that than polyamory. But I'm loath to take a term and ascribe it to myself when I haven't done the intellectual work I need to do.
Right.
To make sure that I understand what I'm talking about. And so it's why I still more call myself a polyamorist. But yeah, I think there's probably a lot there in relationship anarchy that resonates with what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, it makes sense. And, you know, anytime we've had conversations about relationship anarchy on this show in the past, like, we always have to give credit to the fact that at least, you know, where the term was coined was out of a queer community, you know, mm-hmm. and like you're saying, it makes sense because it's, you know, a lot of queer people are the ones who often are like cut off from their families of origin and are kind of forced to like, well, I got to start from scratch here, figuring out what is family, what is partnership, what is friendship, where do those things intersect and how do I move forward from here? And I think this is actually a great segue to my question, which is that in your writings, you know, you have talked about the fact that our traditional notions of the monogamous couple or of the nuclear family, that you specifically use the phrase, they have a hard time containing and often sustaining the complexity of relationships that we as human beings actually need or seek or feel in our lives. And you've also touched on the fact that, you know, for you, that you see specifically like solo polyamory or maybe things like relationship anarchy holding the most promise for challenging these constructs of couple centrism, for instance, and giving space for people to have a variety of relationships that sustain them in their social network. However, I think what I've found personally is that even regardless of the type of romantic or sexual or non-sexual relationships that you choose to have, I feel like people still have a hard time wrapping their head around just the fact that we need a complexity and variety of relationships, you know? Like, I think we're still, at least the way that I was growing up, I was so taught that, like, you know, once you find your soulmate, you're good.
That's all you need.
That's all you need, yeah, you know? Just, like, put all your eggs in that basket, you know? Like, put all your energy towards trying to find that, because once you find that, then you're going to be good. You know, it doesn't matter about your friends or your family, you know, then you're going to be good. And I'm wondering, like, do you see a path forward for even getting people to understand, like, oh, it's not just about finding this one person. It is about this, like, wide tapestry of relationships that we all need as human beings.
You know, I do feel not super hopeful about broader society sometimes, you know, because you look at how we're inundated by all this couple centricity, right? It's in every song, every film, you know, every novel. Right. But where I have hope is, again, just looking at my own community where, you know, as I've written, the couple just didn't get that much play. You know, aunties and grandparents and uncles and cousins, everybody was so important in that kind of broader network of the way that people supported each other. And a lot of people who come from extended family kind of cultures where people still live in extended family will understand that, I think. But still, despite the fact that we actually did a really great job of living in these extended kin networks and not privileging the couple, we were still, in a sense, stigmatized by the dominant society, right? Like as if we were failing at good families. And this is why we've had such a problem with Indigenous children being stolen from their families in both Canada and the U.S. and being forcibly put into boarding schools in the U.S. and they call them residential schools in Canada. I mean, you had, you know, thousands and thousands of children forcibly taken from their families because our families were not considered healthy and normative, right? And they weren't right. considered capable of raising those children. Right. So that's kind of the world that I come from. But so it's that kind of history, but I also still have hope just in the way that we live. I wish we would stop stigmatizing ourselves. I wish we would do... And we do both, right? Like we both, I think, value our extended kinship networks. But we also then still kind of can't completely get away from these dominant standards that we're subjected to.
Gosh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like
that's an answer.
Yeah, no, that is definitely an answer. I mean, so we, you know, part of our Patreon community is this like kind of closed like Facebook discussion group. And I feel like we see that all the time of, again, people, like just people expressing how hard it is to break away from the structures that have been imposed on us from day one, yeah. whether that yeah. is about wanting something that's polyamorous mm-hmm. or if it's about something about like just wanting to be able to prioritize your best friend relationship over your boyfriend or, mm-hmm.
right.
or to be able to co-parent
as
with,
much as,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or being able to co-parent with a friend rather than with a lover. Mm-hmm. And it's just like people, it's definitely caused a lot of pain the way that people struggle mm-hmm. against it. But then, like you said, I think part of it is also a lot of self-stigmatizing as well.
Yeah. What was I going to say? I get really frustrated sometimes with the coming up against these walls. Every way you turn, when you try to do something outside the norm, it feels like you're always hitting a wall.
Yeah.
And I do get really frustrated. But on the other hand, I have so much more freedom than most people. I think because I'm an academic, and academics do tend to, even if they're a bunch of monogamists, you know, running around, they still, I live in a world in which people understand that it's, you question dominant ideas all the time, and that's completely normal. But it's definitely been a challenge for me in terms of the other relationships that I have, because I, you know, we don't live in a world of academics. I don't tend to date people like that, and having to deal with all of the restrictions that they have in their lives, right? And most people in my age, I'm 49, most people in my age group, they don't get to have the kind of freedom to make the kinds of decisions that I can make. They can't be out in the way that I'm out. And that has really, it's been really frustrating for me mm-hmm. to have to look at how they have to deal with families they can't be out to, with children that they can't be out to, right? Yeah. With having to curtail their non-monogamous practice and go back to being monogamous or being in the closet or something. It's hard. And I have a lot of sympathy for people, I guess is my point. I mean, while I sometimes do get frustrated, I have a lot of sympathy because I know most people aren't as privileged as I am to make this kind of decision to live this way.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's something we've definitely talked about amongst ourselves on the podcast, that it's like, obviously not everyone has a long running podcast about non-traditional relationships.
Yeah.
So
not like, everyone can be out.
You don't, yeah. Yeah, not everyone can be out. And you don't have quite that icebreaker on a first date when you're talking about what you do to like start to signal kind of what your values are around relationships. So, yeah.
Yeah. I actually had a question for the end, but I was thinking maybe we could do this now since you kind of segued into it. Would that be okay, Emily?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so when talking about these things, about like significant social change, trying to move away from couple privilege or from mononormativity or, you know, sort of this obsession with state-sanctioned marriage, it can be hard to do that and to talk about that in a way that people can come along with you. So, you know, for example, when we talk about some of the problems inherent in very hierarchical polyamory, it seems like the people who are in those types of relationships, they're kind of faced with this struggle. Either I accept that a large portion of my identity is based on these roles and values, and now all of a sudden I'm like, shit, I'm doing something wrong. I'm upholding something bad. or to go the other way and to sort of justify it and defend it and be like, well, no, you've got to be wrong for some reason. I was curious, have you found a similar kind of situation where, and I have sympathy for it, right? I get that these people are like, how do I take this? How do I go with this? I was curious if you've had a similar thing, a similar type of reaction.
Yeah. There is a lot of that, I think, in my age group. And I have noticed, you know, I try to stick to the structural analyses all the time. And I have noticed sometimes if I come in to, like at Solo Polycon, it was great. I was really pleasantly surprised when I gave that keynote. That wasn't a largely academic audience, but there were so many people there that I think overlap with relationship anarchy, who've thought critically about the state, who think critically about property. So my keynote was really well received there. And I had great questions and conversations. It was one of the best experiences I've had speaking to a non-academic audience and really laying on a heavy structural analysis. Most non-academics are really not into a heavy structural analysis. And I found this on various Facebook pages, for example, dealing with polyamory. People get defensive.
Yeah. Interesting. Even
when I feel like I'm trying to keep it at a structural level and not an individual level, which I do have so much sympathy for. I mean, half the people that I've dated, I've gotten broken up with because it's never even between these long-term married couples, right? Who want to open their marriage. And I've dated mostly straight men, right? It's either the wife wants it more or the husband wants it more. And that doesn't work. You know, it's only been about 20% of the time where both people in the couple who've opened their marriage came to it equally. And so I'm always suffering the collateral damage of people not being able to work against the structure. And I learned a few years ago that I'm just not going to cast blame on people, and I'm not going to resent people for that, that I realize how hard it is to work against that structure, and they're trying as hard as they can. And again, you know, people aren't going to lose their job and their children. You know, this is kind of what it comes down to sometimes, right?
Right.
Yeah. And then for others, they just can't get out of that mindset, you know?
Yeah, it is definitely a different thing, like with the mindset thing, because I think that was also something that I ran up against once I started like working with people as a coach, is that it's like so many people would come to me being like, I'm totally down with this whole, you know, dumping hierarchy and all, like I see all the problems with hierarchical structure and I really want to live my life and create my relationships in such a way that don't, you know, stick to this strict hierarchy. But I've also been married and co-parenting with this person for 20 years. Like, how do I do this? Mm-hmm. How do I, like, I can't just like throw that out the window, you know? And so again, it's that same thing where it's like, I can't tell people like, no, you gotta throw it all on its head and you gotta get rid of, you know, completely change everything you've been doing for the last 20 years
Well, and it's easier for me being a solo person. I mean, I left my marriage before I realized that this is what I needed to do. I thought that it just wasn't the right marriage for me.
Right.
And then soon after, because if I could go back, you know, 6 years ago and know that actually what I needed to do was ask to open my marriage and to live in separate houses and to not present normatively as a couple and do all this couple-y centric kind of settler family presentation to the world. But I didn't know that, right? Like, I totally didn't know that that's what was going on. But being a solo person now, it's easier for me, I recognize, than to open a long-term marriage. I have a lot of sympathy for how difficult that must be.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
For a long time now, we've been fans of AdamandEve.com for getting sex toys or lingerie or accessories, things like that. It's just a fantastic resource with a huge selection. And now, not only do we have a fantastic offer, but we also have a promo code that will work on AdamMale.com and EvesToys.com, which are their sites specifically for LGBTQ audiences. And our code is fantastic. It's 50% off of almost any item in the store and free discreet shipping when you use our code MULTI.
Yes, we love AdamandEve.com and have for years. They are our oldest and longest sponsor, and they just keep on giving great gifts to us and to our listeners. You can bring more pleasure and satisfaction into your bedroom by going to adamandeve.com, adammail.com, or evestoys.com and select any one item. It can be, you know, an adventurous new toy or anything you desire, something fun, something sexy, whatever sounds good.
So just enter offer code MULTI at checkout and you'll get 50% off almost any item plus free shipping. That's MULTI, M-U-L-T-I, at adamandeve.com, adammail.com, or evestoys.com. This is an exclusive offer that is specific to this podcast, and it's better than any offer that is currently available on their site. So again, use code MULTI to get you not just the 50% discount, but also the 100% free shipping. Code M-U-L-T-I.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about it, kind of the current time in which we're living, because it seems maybe it's settled down slightly, but it definitely, the Me Too movement and toxic masculinity and all of this stuff, it reminded me, or it brought up things when I was reading about settler sexuality from you, and just that there was potentially a connection between the two, and just this idea that relationships are sort of this entitlement thing, and that centricity sort of is like an entitlement for sex or relationship or like a specific structure or anything. And it made me think that perhaps like people talking about the Me Too movement, talking about the way in which femmes or women are treated, and just sort of changing that narrative, that perhaps it makes way a bit for the narrative around the way in which we do relationships, that narrative can also change as well. And I don't know, I was curious to hear your thoughts about that, because it sounded as though perhaps you were hesitant and didn't really think that much maybe will change. But I know that things have been disrupted currently in this state that we're in. And so I was kind of wondering about what you thought about that.
What I think about Me Too?
Well, more just, do you think that it is a way in which people can start moving forward and thinking about relationships, thinking about the way in which women have been, I guess, systematically treated over the years by men, for example? And because I kind of see it all in a similar fashion. Obviously, that's been happening for a long, long time, but I do see a connection between what you speak of and what you write about and sort of what's happening right now and the disruption and the change.
You know, I guess, think that's...
Yeah.
I think that's a really good question. I haven't actually thought enough probably about the connection between what the Me Too moment's going to generate in terms of shifts in the way that people do relationships. I think it's really important that women are supporting each other right now in being so vocal about those. I mean, we all have these Me Too stories, right? And, you know, there's many more that are going to come out. I mean, every time I listen to these, I think about all the stories I'm not really willing to share yet publicly for very good reasons. And so nothing surprises me that people come out with. But I don't know yet if that's going to translate into shifting norms around relationships. I mean, I guess I would assume so. What I do notice is among younger Indigenous feminists, because these are the people that I've talked to most, Indigenous feminists and queer and two-spirit people, I do notice how much less younger people are just willing to put up with the BS that my generation put up with. And they're not willing to be quiet. And I think that's like really inspiring. I don't mean to like put it all on young people. That's terrible that people do that, right? Oh, the young are going to save us because we're leaving them this like crap world, right? but
they've clearly shown that they have a lot of spirit currently. I mean, it is, a lot has been happening around the young people.
And I think they're
in our current situation.
They're leading us ethically and conceptually to places that I think maybe some of us that are older can follow.
Yeah.
But
I see that at least it has brought light to this idea of like, you know, of entitlement over the bodies of certain people that some people hold over the bodies of certain other people.
Yeah.
And Yeah. And I don't know. I guess my whole thing as all of this has been coming to light is just hoping, like just really, really hoping that it doesn't all just kind of like that the rage machine doesn't just kind of settle like it does so often on the internet, you know, that there's some kind of like lasting opening up change moving forward here. At least that's what I always think of.
I think the willingness to call out abusive behavior, and I don't want to just say like it, call it out publicly. I'm searching for other words that are actually going back to my culture. Because we had a tradition, and I actually heard that this happened behind the scenes at Standing Rock, but people didn't talk about it as much publicly because, you know, they wanted to keep internal dynamics internal. But there was a calling to account. That's a better term. Mm-hmm. There were Indigenous women there calling men to account who were acting in abusive ways, and it didn't make it publicly, and it didn't need to make it. It didn't need to be. Nobody needed to know about those, because Indigenous women were taking care of it, mm-hmm. you know. And I see Me Too, I think, as in women in general calling men to account. And I think that's a really important thing that a lot of Indigenous communities do. And I think the broader society needs to do that. And I guess that's how I would frame that versus saying it's calling out on social media. I would, you know, you need to call people to account. And part of that is, and there's a debate going on around this actually too, right? Some people are talking about, I can't remember the term that they're using, about when you call people to account, you give men ways to sort of redeem themselves. And other people are saying, no, you know, I don't want to go there yet. You know, I don't feel safe enough to go there. So there is these kinds of active conversations going on among young feminists about how to call people account and then what you do about it. Yeah. We also had a tradition in among my people of casting people out who did irredeemable damage in a community, you know, so there's, there's all kinds of things we're talking about now about how to, and I think these conversations are great. So I think that has fundamentally changed, and I don't think we're just going to go back to not talking about these things anymore. I do think there has at least been that shift. Whether that's going to translate into real changes in relationships, you know, that might be a multi-generational project. But
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the context where this was, but I have heard the term calling in being used as opposed to calling out, right. with the idea being, and we talked about this a little bit on our episode recently about online arguments, but this idea that calling out can sometimes end up having a certain like performative aspect to it, especially with the other people who will jump in to like support this will sometimes be like, oh, I'm going to talk so much shit about this person who someone said did a bad thing because then somehow I'm not bad, you know, kind of there's a performative aspect to it. Whereas calling in sounds kind of more like what you were talking about of like within our community, we're going to come in and talk about this and, you know, see if there's a way for this person to redeem themselves or not, and really have the focus be on education rather than on kind of a public shaming or something like that.
Well, I'm going to hop on that though.
Sure, yeah.
Sorry, just because I also want to bring up like the, but then the other side of that conversation is like, how much of calling in is trying to protect someone who's an abuser, you know, and like trying to protect someone's feelings. And so there's, I've also seen that conversation of like, of course, there is also some value to public shaming as well, you know? So it is just kind of definitely a nuanced conversation, but sorry to step on you, Kim.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think probably all of those strategies are important at different times. So,
Yeah.
The next question we have here is a little bit of a change of direction. So in one of your articles, this was, I'm blanking on which one this was, but I'll just quote you to yourself again. You said, that we fetishize the couple, making it stand at the heart of love and family, which are actually the product of much more complex social biological relations. And, I think this word fetishize is really interesting because I know that within a lot of these conversations that we have or that I have with non-monogamous people or people as part of the kink community or other things, that fetish is another one of these ones, like queer, I guess, that I feel like in certain contexts can have a slightly different definition. And so I was curious about how you were using it here. And then I might have some more questions after that, but I was just curious if you could talk about that.
They must be related. So how would you define it? And you know, like kink communities, how would you define fetish?
Well, so within the kink community, fetish has sort of taken on a slightly different meaning where fetish and kink almost can be used interchangeably when used as a noun to mean this is sort of a thing that I'm into that might not be normal, you know, that might not be normative. And I realize that's a very different definition than what fetish was originally meant to mean. And so that's why I wanted to bring it up. Because, you know, people will talk about, oh, you know, my fetish is for, I don't know.
Latex or whatever.
Well, I feel like that's a little bit more the traditional meaning of like, I'm obsessed over an object. Whereas I feel like people will say like, oh, my fetish is, you know, I don't know, animal role play. Or something like that.
Right, a particular role play, yeah.
Right, that it's more of a particular thing I'm into, which is a little bit different than the initial meaning. So I was just curious about how you were using it in this context.
Well, so I'm taking the word fetishization from its use in commodity fetishism, which Marx talked about, and then gene fetishism, which my PhD advisor, Donna Haraway, talked about, who's drawing on Marx. And so I wrote about gene fetishism in my book, Native American DNA, and that is the collapsing of elaborate sets of social relations over time and across bodies down to the molecular structure into the idea of a DNA marker. So these ideas of Native American DNA, they come to signify this kind of, that's what it is to be Native American. Well, if you look at what created what constitutes a Native American, it's not just the molecules. I mean, it's not that those things don't matter at any level, but there's all these sets of social relations that occur across the tribe and the clan and the family, and they occur over time. They get embedded in your body. This is what it means when I and others talk about things being biosocial. I'm not just a social constructionist. I believe that our body comes to embody physical things in the world. Our biology changes in response to social structures. And so when I talk about the couple getting fetishized, I'm talking about that. That's that couple, they come to stand as like kind of the core and the center of the family and that whole unit. But in my culture, and I think for a lot of us, it's not just about it's that man and that woman, or now it can be same-sex couples, but who are all of the people that help constitute that family, you know, even for people who consider themselves, I think, very nuclear family and couple centric. You don't get to exist in a vacuum. There's a whole set of social relations that are helping support you. But I don't remember what and if I think into kink as well, I wonder if that fetish actually also embodies a bunch of social relations, but it just as you end up focusing on that particular scene or that particular object. But of course, it's so much more than that, right? That is creating and constituting desire and the interactions that are happening around that object or that scene or that role. So I would imagine that's where that term fetish comes into play there as well.
Yeah, interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it was interesting because I looked up the definition when I was coming up with this question when I was reading one of your articles, and the definition that I looked up was interesting. So the first definition it had was kind of what we were talking about, right? It says a sexual desire in which gratification is linked to an abnormal degree to a particular object.
To an abnormal degree, quote unquote.
Right. So there's problematic things in that whole thing. But I think that's sort of the definition that I think most of us are familiar with. What was interesting is the second definition here is an inanimate object worshipped for its supposed magical powers or because it's believed to be inhabited by a spirit. And I had never heard that.
Oh, really?
That definition of it. So that was really interesting. Yeah. That there may have also been sort of a religious or spiritual practice that word was also associated with.
Well, and that would apply to the way that Native American DNA gets taken up, right? Or I think the way that the couple gets up. These are things that are both held up and lionized as being these important kinds of goals that people have, you know, they do become magical in some sense. So.
Well, I guess
we were just talking about that.
Yeah, this idea of like once I become a couple or once I find my soulmate or once I get that particular relationship format, it does have the magic to like solve all my problems, essentially.
Yeah.
Or it in itself is magical enough like to sustain us. Like, I don't know. I guess that just ties into that whole narrative we've been taught since we've been very young by most of our like movies and TV shows and things like that.
Well, I think that actually... Sorry, this is sort of blowing my mind here a little bit, thinking about this. But something that we've talked about a lot is the over-romanticization of romance. The idea of thinking of romance as something very magical and that has more, that has meaning that exists outside of what actually is there. And I think that if we were to look at that definition of fetish and applying it to a couple, for example, I definitely see this thing where people will prioritize preserving a relationship over the happiness or well-being of anyone actually involved in the relationship. Mm. Right? Like the way that we, you know, the people who say like, well, you should never get divorced, or who try to make that more difficult, or that's not something you can do. It's this idea that somehow the relationship of the couple or the marriage itself is the thing that is magical or has meaning, and not the people who are actually in it.
Mm. Yeah, you just answered the question, your own question.
Gosh, sorry, I had to...
That was good. You had to get there on your own.
I had to get there, yeah. Wow, yeah, fantastic. I've heard also people theorize that monogamy itself might be a fetish, that that could be a way of thinking about monogamy. I thought that was an interesting one, but we don't have to get into all that.
Like that we culturally fetishize that, perhaps.
Right. I think it's trying to make the argument that at our nature, people wouldn't be monogamous, and we can choose to do it if we want, but that's sort of like a fetish too. It's like, well, I'm choosing to enforce a particular type of relationship limitations or structure onto it. I don't know. It's a theory I've heard out there, but I thought of it because it's using that word fetish also to try to look at something sort of in reverse of how we normally do.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I mean, this has been just a really interesting discussion. I feel like we've gone to all kinds of different territories here. Yeah. And I could definitely sit here, Kim, and like pick your brain for hours and hours and hours, but I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do instead is I'm going to ask, where can people find more about you and about your work?
Well, so my blog, criticalpolyamorous.com, although I've been doing more academic writing lately, so I haven't been updating it every month like I should. So I also have a new chapter out in a book that just came out last month. The book is called Making Kin, Not Population, and it is on Prickly Paradigm Press, which is part of the University of Chicago Press. And I have a chapter in there on settler sex and family. So in fact, certain parts of my blogs were drafted and then kind of informed that chapter. Yes. I've got a lot of YouTube talks. I guess I give a lot of talks and people put me up on YouTube. So a quick Google and you'll see my talks. I think that's what I've been doing. Oh, and then the other thing is I'm a co-producer of a sexy storytelling show called TP Confessions, which is our parent show is Bedpost Confessions out of Austin, Texas, a very, very popular show there. And we are doing that show 3 to 4 times a year in Edmonton and other cities. And we're about to launch our webpage, tpconfessions.com. And we'll be coming to a city near you. So
nice. Excellent. Yeah. That sounds great.
Is that that's something awesome. People can find online as well, or is it only a live show?
The show's live, but we are, like Bedpost Confessions does, they have their own website. We are going to start putting clips from our shows in sort of like podcast format as well.
Nice.
Right. Yeah, and we'll figure out where it goes. I just got a big grant in Canada to produce the show and build an arts-based research lab around it.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. Very so cool. it'll get even bigger and better.
Excellent. So,
that's wonderful.
Excellent. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you again so much for sharing all your wisdom and knowledge today, Kim.
Well, thanks for having me on.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can send an email to info@multiamory.com or send us a message on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. You can also leave us a voicemail at 678-MULTI-05, or you can leave us a voice message on Facebook. To support our show and join our private Facebook community and Discourse server, go to patreon.com/multiamory. Multiamory is created and produced by Emily Matlack, Dedeker Winston, and me, Jace Lindgren. Our episodes are edited by Mauricio. Our social media wizard is Will McMillan. Our theme song is Forms I Know I Did by Josh and Anand from the Fractal Cave EP. The full transcript is available on this episode's page on multiamory.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.